I appreciate all the speakers freeing up their time to come here today and talk to us. Our next speaker of this session is Dr. Greg Brick. He has a PhD in geology from the University of Minnesota. Professionally, he was employed as a hydrogeologist at several environmental consulting firms and taught geology at local colleges and universities. His first book, Iowa Underground, A Guide to the State's Subterranean Treasures, was published in 2004, and his second book, Subterranean Twin Cities, was published in 2009. That one won an award from the local chapter of the American Institute of Architects. He mapped the springs of the Minneapolis and St. Paul regions in 1993, and he's here to talk to us today about the Minnesota Spring Inventory, so welcome and thank you.
Springs are groundwater discharge points, and until recently, most of the mapped springs in Minnesota that were actually in a database were from the southeastern counties, the so-called karst features database, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a moment. But until now, there had been no statewide spring inventory. And this was a project that was promoted by Jeff Green and Jan Faltasek, and going to the LCCMR and getting the required funding for this program. It is basically what we're going to do is with the spring inventory is harvest all the existing spring points that are not in the present karst features database. And then we're going to take the mapping statewide out into the glaciated parts of the state and so on. And most of our work has focused on public lands, simply because they're the easiest to access. But I'd like to emphasize this program does include private lands, springs in any part of the state. And I'll say a little bit more near the end of this about how you can help with this spring inventory and how the public in general. Now, this is sort of the task we are faced with. I'll give you a good idea of just what a terra incognita Minnesota is with regard to springs. You see in the southeastern corner of the state, the karst features database points, about 3,000 of them. But the rest of the state is blank. So that's what I'm here to address with my colleagues. And this is in comparison with our friends to the east in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Conservation Department from 1956 to 1962 mapped about 10,000 springs in their state. And although that's a huge number, that's it's estimated they only covered about two-thirds of the known springs there. So they still have a ways to go. But with the Wisconsin Conservation Department program, it was kind of a top-down thing where there was an order given to all the conservation officers to go out and map the springs in their bailiwick. And so it's not the case here. Just want to go through a little bit on the history of springs in Minnesota. And the larger goal I have here is to show you some of the diversity of Minnesota springs. I launch into a presentation on springs, people will say, what are you talking about? What does a spring look like? You know, if you're from the southeast, you probably know very well what a spring looks like. But otherwise, you may be scratching your head. You might not have seen all that many springs, although they are very common in the environment around us. So historically speaking, interestingly enough, The history of springs in Minnesota actually has a prehistory. It goes back before European settlement. The Native Americans had legends and stories about springs. The best known locally is at Camp Coldwater, which is in Minneapolis and just near the VA hospital off of Hiawatha. And Native American bands believe that this was where one of their subterranean gods, Ungtahi, lived. And occasionally, if you'd see bubbling in the spring, well, that was just him down there, you know, taking a few breaths in the water, if he roils the water, or so on. And I'm sure you might have remembered the dispute, the Highway 55 reroute dispute, which heavily involved this Native American site. It also is one of the earliest springs in Minnesota that was turned into a water supply during European settlement. It was, of course, the spring right next to Fort Snelling that was used by the soldiers for the water supply. The city of St. Paul was famously, supposedly founded at Fountain Cave, which is, the cave still exists. It's buried by highway construction right near Randolph and Shepherd Road. But this was supposed to be the place where Pig's Eye Perrant built his saloon, and it was a spring cave. And the name Fountain means spring. And you can see the water flowing out there in the earliest image of a Minnesota cave. Caves were also, springs were also used as health resorts. I think the best known historically in Minnesota was a place known as Calibiot Springs, and it was in Minneapolis. It was also known as the St. Anthony Falls Mineral Springs, and it was right below the falls in what is now Pillsbury Park. And these springs are still flowing down there. In fact, they're used by U of M students for collecting samples and so on. But it was a health resort. It was nationally known health resort. And in the years before the Civil War, Southerners who were looking to escape the heat of the Deep South before the advent of air conditioning would actually come up here for the summer. And some of them would take the waters at Calibiot Springs. What was it good for? Well, Calibiot means iron-bearing. And these were, so if you had iron deficiency, of course, nowadays, if that were the case, you'd just take a dietary supplement. I guess back then you would travel all the way up here to get your iron. But it was also recommended for other more questionable purposes, such as tuberculosis. I have no idea what the effect of this, how this spring, these spring waters would help you if you had tuberculosis. Another spa, a little closer in time, 1920s, the Mudbottom Spa down by Jordan, Minnesota. A very interesting place that still requires some investigation. It says the home of the original sulfur mud baths of the Northwest. These spring waters are down in what is now the Louisville Swamp Unit, a National Wildlife Refuge. And I found an old postcard there showing one of the actual springs routed through a curious concrete flask. And I still haven't figured out what that's about. I think it may be some kind of venting system, because these were sulfur-rich waters, hydrogen sulfide from the wetlands, and they may have been trying to vent off the H2S. Springs were also used as water supplies, much more so than they are today. The city of Grand Marais, as recently as World War II, took all its drinking water from springs along the Gunflint Trail. And when I called the mayor up there to ask him where the springs were, he was just completely dumbfounded, as were the Public Works Department. And it took some Beating the Bushes by Jeff Green and I to actually locate the old water supply springs, but they are they're there back in the woods near the Gunflint Trail. Suffice it to say, the city of Grand Marais now takes its water supply from Lake Superior. They no longer use these springs. They just run them into the storm sewers. Springs were also valuable where you could get them for operating mills. Now, any run-of-the-mill mill can be run on a surface stream. That's easy enough. But in winter, in our Minnesota winters, those streams freeze, and the mills have to shut down for the season. Well, what if you had a place where the springs, where the streams ran all year long, all winter, because of the springs in them keeping them warm? And some of the historic mills, such as the Pickwick Mill in southeastern Minnesota, were spring mills, and so you get a much higher productivity. You're grinding wheat and so on, making flour. But it's not only human beings that benefit from springs. Their wildlife, especially trout, and the fisheries, people are very concerned about springs. Springs maintain a uniform water temperature, which is, of course, warmer seeming in winter and colder seeming in summer. And this will help, you know, with their eggs and the adult phase in their survival. Willowbrook Fish Hatchery in St. Paul. A lot of people don't know that we had a fish hatchery right here in the Twin Cities. And it was built around the largest spring in St. Paul, 400 gallons per minute, down just off of Indian Mounds Park along what is now Warner Road. Another value for wildlife that's not commonly thought of is that springs help provide open water in winter for migratory and other wildfowl. And I took this photograph in Fort Snelling State Park last winter, and you can see there is a nice area of open water for these trumpeter swans, who incommoded me with their incessant trumpetings. But I was told later that I should actually be glad of that, because it's very difficult to get there the exact day when the trumpeters are coming through. So I was actually blessed. And there is a photograph of the spring coming out of the St. Peter sandstone there. Here's another way in which springs help overwintering animals. If they can't fly away, they're not migratory wildfowl or something, they can stay in springs all winter long. That water is maintained is... even though a spring is typically at our latitude of 47 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 degrees centigrade, on a day in winter when it's 20 below, that spring is going to seem like a hot spring to the creatures around there. And so Carver's Cave in St. Paul in the Bruce Vento Nature Sanctuary I visited that cave in winter. And the lake inside that cave was full of frogs who, if they had come out in the open, would have froze solid. And, of course, calcareous fens and other seepage prairies and such environments are dependent on groundwater resources. It's very important to maintain their flows. This is a photograph of the Sioux Nation Fen in western Minnesota, and that is what we call an artesian blister mound in the distance there. The groundwater is just basically coming up and has this area of spongy ground. To say a few words about past surveys of springs in Minnesota, the most famous one was by Thaddeus Serber. And he was superintendent of fish propagation at the predecessor of the DNR in the 1920s and earlier. And So he was very concerned about trout and trout habitat. And so he walked 1,000 miles up the river, he says, and all its tributaries, mapping the springs there very systematically. And his work is still of great value today. He was also the person who picked the location of the Lanesboro fish hatchery based on where he found the best springs. And that seems like kind of a trivial point, but you have to realize that a lot of the locations of fish hatcheries in Minnesota don't really make sense. They were political choices. And now I hear that the French River hatchery is closing. I'm not sure what the exact background is on that, but again, a legislator wants a hatchery in their district, and so voila, you get a hatchery, whether it makes sense or not. So Serber also mapped springs on the north shore of Lake Superior, and he created a work of art, a giant linen tube by 5 feet in size, containing more than the locations of more than 50 springs, and this was in the days before Highway 61 was put in and basically gave access to, much greater numbers of the public, and put quite a strain on the resources up there. So he saw it back when it was more pristine. Okay, so here is a map of showing Minnesota with the blue points being the KARST Features database points. This is our existing survey that we were beginning from with the new statewide inventory. And there are about 3,000 points now in that database. Collected over the years, especially since the 1970s, by people such as Calvin Alexander at the U of M, Bob Tipping at MGS, and Jeff Green at the DNR. And now you can see some of our new springs added in there, the red ones. And we have about 2,000 points. The program has just begun. And these 2,000 points include what I call legacy data and then newly mapped springs. Now, the red points, the legacy data, these are actually points that were, they're not exactly new springs, but they were springs that were, for example, mapped by the DNR fisheries in the 1940s onwards. It's just that no one had bothered to go into the fisheries files and actually put them into an electronic database. So that was a huge addition to this to the legacy data that I was working with. Plus, I have personally mapped a lot of the springs in the Minnesota River Valley while testing out some of our equipment that I'll show in a moment. Just a few words about spring classification, and here again, this is just one of the underlying things I'm trying to do here is give you an idea of the diversity of Minnesota springs, what they look like. They come in all different colors, shapes, and sizes, so to speak. The spring classification that we have adopted is rather different than there are some huge spring inventories going on in the southwestern United States, and they use what is called a sphere of discharge terminology in classifying their springs. And this is also used by a lot of consultants here in Minnesota, so it's not completely irrelevant to us. I just saw a report on the springs in the Uniman sand mine, and that they are using, the consultant there used this ecological classification of springs, as it's called. And basically, a sphere of discharge terminology is basically not so interested in the spring as the sort of environment that it creates around the spring. That's why it's a sphere of discharge. Whereas geologists, and especially in this spring inventory, we are more concerned with a traditional, what is known as point of discharge terminology. Okay, so we're going exclusively with that kind of thing. And you have examples of that here. Schwartz and Teal, this is a prominent spring classification in the 1950s, large parts which are still relevant and which we're building on. See examples there of contact springs, depression or water table springs, cave springs, and so on. So I'm not going to go through every single category of spring that we have established. Again, the idea here is more just to show you different varieties and the diversity of Minnesota springs. Here is an example of a contact spring prominent in the southeastern counties, where you have bedrock, sedimentary bedrock, especially exposed at the surface, where you have two units that contact each other, basically. And as Kelvin Alexander collecting a water sample, and you can kind of see the contact runs right there through the Platteville limestone. This is High Duck Spring in the city of Minneapolis, and it is used by the local residents. They collect water there in great quantities. If you go to this spring, which is sort of near the Milwaukee Road trestle crossing the Mississippi River, you'll see plastic jugs laying all over down there. And that's because, people are collecting water, and they believe that even though this spring is in a residential area, I mean, right on top of that bluff there is West River Parkway, and their house is all over there. They believe that this water is much purer than what they get out of their taps. An interesting conclusion, actually. I can't say either way. I haven't had the guts to drink it, Russ. Cave springs, very easily identified type. Fluvial springs, or springs coming out on riverbanks. I might say that the classification that we have adopted for this new spring inventory it's kind of ranked from top to bottom. That is to say, the really good choices that you want, the really discrete, exact scientific categories that you like to put the spring in, like a contact spring of this and that geologic unit, very identifiable. That's a choice at the top. And as you make your way down, there are less appealing kinds of choices just based on the fact you don't have access to the geology. You can't exactly tell what's going on there. So a fluvial spring is one that you find on a riverbank or in a riverbed. And here's an example of a sand boil surrounded by watercress. I believe this is at the St. Croix Watershed Research Station. They're very proud of this. A littoral spring is a spring on a lake shore, on a shoreline, basically. And that can be a spring that's above the waterline or below the waterline. And that's important because we don't want springs changing, switching, having to be put in different categories depending on whether the water is high or low. So with the littoral spring here, with this example, I mapped this spring when it was a low water level. And you can see that the lake is way out there. A river level, actually that's the Minnesota River in the background, river level was down. But when river level comes up, this spring gets completely submerged, and I don't want to have to reclassify it. So littoral is a convenient way of covering both those situations. Same thing with fluvial. This is what I call a pipe spring. It's like, where is it coming from? I don't know. Unless I go in this guy's backyard and annoy him very much by ripping up his backyard and finding out where that pipe starts from. Maybe it starts from a buried rock. Maybe it's a glassier fluvial lens or something in there, but I don't know. So I'm forced to kind of stick it in this category of of pipe springs for want of a anything better. The landowner brought us out here and invited us to drink from it. Do you think he would invite the DNR to drink from his sump water? Yeah, you got a point there, I guess. So we're collecting the basic hydrologic information that geologists would collect, temperature, dissolved oxygen, and so on. We're also collecting just a little bit of biological information as long as we're at the spring and it's easily accessible and we can see it right there and write it down. Why not? And so we're looking at things such as the presence or absence of amphipods in the springs. This is an amphipod. It is a freshwater shrimp, about the size of a pumpkin seed. Very easy to identify, a favorite food of trout. But the main thing here is that there was a big study done by Muck and Newman on this campus, no less, in 1992, where they looked at how valuable amphipods are as water quality indicators. Very easy water quality indicators. Where you find these amphipods, the water temperature is below 20 degrees centigrade. The spring is perennial, because if it dried up all the time, these things would die off. And also, you know, it's a spring that doesn't have like major pulses of pesticides coming through. And by pesticides, that includes herbicides. If you have, after a storm event, runoff from the fields, if you had even a bunch of herbicide passed through this spring, it would kill off these amphipods, even though they're animals and it's, you know, herbicides are for plants. So it's an important water quality indicator. Marsh marigolds. Don Rosenberry of the USGS did a big study at Lake Shingabee up near Walker, Minnesota. And one of the things he noticed right away is there's like a 100% correlation between finding marsh marigolds along lake shores and where there are seepages coming out. And he went and he published a famous paper in Groundwater talking about that. And he took a boat and he went around the perimeter of the lake and mapping the marsh marigolds, and voila, that's actually where the springs were. Here's some other interesting, there's some interesting biology going on here. Not being a biologist, I cannot address it directly, but it's certainly something worth recording in this large spring up near Walker, Minnesota, if you came across it. The spring is just boiling up over a large area here, and there are all these orange bacterial flocks just kind of floating around in there. And the black mats there are cyanobacterial mats, or in other words, blue-green algae. And sometimes springs can become infested with fungi or overgrown with fungi. And this is an example. I call it Superfund Springs. You see the fungus growing. So this is the Platteville limestone here, vertical fissure. The water is coming out right there and flowing down. And this white mass here, you see, this is not water. This is actually the fungus itself. It's a saprolegnia, to be exact. And there is just a horrible sulfide odor associated with this spring. And what it is that there's a Superfund site in downtown Minneapolis nearby, and the water has been seeping through there, and microorganisms are living on the PAHs and other substances that are coming through with the spring water. And there's a whole series of these white springs along the bluffs in downtown Minneapolis in that area of seepage. And it almost looks like bird droppings just on the rocks. The theme of this conference is advances, and so I'll just talk about some of the tools we're using in the Minnesota Spring Inventory, developed in conjunction with our IT folks. And of course, we all know about LIDAR and color infrared imagery. This has been of immense value in mapping the springs. I mapped the springs of the Twin Cities area back in the early 90s, and this was before GPS, low-cost GPS units, and this is before LIDAR, and it was just like putting pencil points on paper topographic maps. And so I came into this thinking topographic maps were the best sort of coverage, but I found out immediately that LIDAR is the best kind of coverage for doing the sort of spring work that I do. And LIDAR, again, is light detection and ranging. We're all familiar with those nasty people who point lasers at airplanes, but occasionally the airplanes point the lasers down at us, and that's basically what LIDAR is. Mapping the surface with these light beams in very high resolution. I zoomed in on this image of Lebanon Hills Regional Park. It's an area containing moraines, and it's morainal topography. I wanted to just kind of test out my skills because I'd never been to this park before. I wanted to see how good I was. It was a blind test. Went down there, parked my car. I asked the usual question at the gate. Of the people there at the park, where are the springs in the park? Got the usual answer, there are no springs here. And that basically is with the starting point of any spring survey when somebody says there are no springs here. And then you go find them. So I looked at my LIDAR coverage, which I had on my tablet, which I'll show you in a moment, and I noticed these kinds of squiggly landforms. And I thought, these are potential springs. And I went and ground truth that, and indeed they were springs. And the red arrow here is, I was particularly happy about. When I went to where that red arrow is, I found a spring there that was flowing at about 1 gallon per minute. So what I'm saying here is you can pick out springs flowing as with a flow rate as low as 1 gallon per minute on LIDAR if you know what you're looking for. And each different part of the state, each different association of landforms, whether you're in morainal topography, that LIDAR signature is going to be different than if you're in, just areas of where bedrock is exposed at the surface, obviously. But here's another way in which LIDAR can be used to inform where to look for springs. There are not many of us working on this statewide spring inventory at the DNR. So we need to, co-op and get other people's help. But so we have to make use of the tools when we're going out in the field. And this is a LIDAR image of the Lake Agassiz beach ridges, which stretch from about the Minnesota River Valley up to the Canadian border along the western border of Minnesota. And I've circled here some interesting features that I would go check out. I have no idea at this point whether those are actually springs or just, surface water, but it helps me really narrow down my focus where I want to look. It also evaluated thermal infrared imagery. And this is a shot from a FLIR camera. FLIR stands for forward-looking infrared. And it's an interesting kind of camera that shoots two pictures simultaneously. But because the lenses are physically in two different places, the images are not exactly, it doesn't capture exactly the same frame, exactly the same thing. But on the left, you can see what it looks like in visual light, and on the right, in this thermal imagery. And the arrow there is pointing to, it's brighter. Those bright dots there are actually, That's a groundwater emanation a quarter of a mile away across the Mississippi River. It's down Lilydale Regional Park. I was able to confirm that. But one of the annoying aspects of the this thermal infrared imagery, there's lots of artifacts. So you see this here, you say, oh, well, that must be some real gushers of springs down there then. I mean, look how they're so much warmer and so on. No, I think that's just riprap over there. It's just the bare rocks catch the light and you know, so they give more of a heat signature. Now, needless to say, if I were taking the same two pictures in the middle of summer, the springs would be highlighted in the opposite sense. They would be the cold things that would be picked out on the landscape. Here in winter, they're picked out as the warm warm glowing objects. And what you're seeing here, basically it's the, use this illustration about how FLIR works. Here you see a cat that has just walked across the kitchen floor. Look how sensitive that is. Just look at that. I mean, the cat's footprint, you know, a cat walking, you know, just across the floor, the infinitesimal amount of time its feet are in contact with the linoleum, and this camera can pick that up. Now, I didn't shoot this picture with that in mind. I was just goofing off, but I thought it was just like, wow. But what you're seeing here, again, this is not a cat seen in infrared light, because you cannot see infrared light by definition. What happens here is that any false color imagery picks up, it will take that infrared and assign value, the software will assign values in the visual range to it and then throw it back at you, and you get these colors that aren't the real colors of the object. A few tools, I'll just finish up here with some tools of data management that we're working on. We are using a tablet in the field. We have remote upload with Esri products, a collector, and Survey 123. We collect a bunch of information at each spring. You know, of course, the GPS location is critical, and then such things. If there's a decent flow rate, things such as dissolved oxygen, temperature, and so on. And then, like I said, it can be remotely uploaded. Now, what I need to tell you here is that this system that we're developing, this tablet system, is parallel to another system, which I'll say a bit about in another slide, that is for the public. This system is strictly for professionals at the DNR and MGS and University of Minnesota researchers. We're developing an app that can be used by citizens and everyone else. So this is the professional grade version what we're doing. So those springs then are transferred from the field back to servers at the DNR. And here's what you would see on the web page interface when you got back to the office. You see those springs are shown there. Just some features of the system I'd like to point out. Here we have a coverage bar. You can get it right now. It's on, I guess, what you call street coverage. There's light gray, LIDAR or hill shade, hydrologic position coverage, and then aerial photography. And then here on the right, you have legend search. You can add a spring and so on. But again, at this stage, with this tablet system, the three entities I mentioned, the only ones adding the spring locations. So here I've just kind of zoomed into the St. Paul area on that web interface, and I've switched to aerial coverage. And I've just taken the side panel out there, and you can see now we get a legend here. So in the yellow springs are the published locations that anyone could see by accessing this. And by the way, you know, it will be, you know, so the general public can look at it. So they'd be able to see any of these yellow locations. The red locations, these are unpublished. So if I logged a bunch of spring locations in the field, I got back to the office, they'd all be red. And I would have to go through those and double check that they're valid locations. You know, it wasn't a waypoint, or I didn't, you know, marking the location of something else as I often do, like how far I got during the day. I can eliminate all those points and only promote, as it's called, the valid locations to be true springs. Here on this side panel is pulled out to show some of the attributes that you can record about the spring. And again, these are all on the tablet in the field. And this is actually quite a lengthy list that goes on some way, just seeing the top of it here. The name of the spring, you know, when you're there, is it a seep or a spring, its arrangement, the lithology, what sort of rock or unconsolidated material is the spring emanating from. And here's the other track that I mentioned, the citizen track or the public track. So all that was just for the professionals. But here I'd like to enlist your help and, as sort of in a beta testing mode to help us try out this spring app. It's almost ready. And this is sort of, these are some screenshots from a smartphone. So the idea here, basically, I think we got this from the bee people who were buzzing around one day with their cute little app. And what they do is you have your smartphone, you take a picture of a bee, and there's, you know, a location generated. Then that goes back to the office, and then an entomologist then can look at that and say, oh, here's a new distribution record for this Apis mellifera or whatever it is. And so we're adapting that. One of our mandates is to promote citizen science. And so many people know about spring. We can't be everywhere. It's just a few of us at the DNR working on this. And so we're trying to crowdsource this. And so the idea here, and we're going to just give it a test, see how it works, is you take your smartphone. When this whole thing is rolled out, you take a picture of the spring, record some of this basic data. You know, if you know the name of the spring, you know, is it flowing, the origin, in other words, that's the spring classification. And that links to pictures of springs. Because again, a lot of times when you ask people, how are your springs? And they say, what springs? Or what do they look like? What am I supposed to be looking for? And so to take care of that, we have pictures of these of the various different kinds of springs, and any other general comments that people want to make about that, if it has some alternate name or something. And then they can send this to us, and of course it's geo-referenced because, you know, the GPS and the phone picture comes to our office, and then it's not going to go directly into our database. We have to evaluate it first. Okay, so we have to look at that information and check to make sure it looks kosher. And then we're going to see how this system works. But we would like your help. We're going to put a notice in the MGWA newsletter about this. But basically, right now, if you wanted to access this kind of thing, what you do is just go to the DNR webpage. And type springs into the search box, and the first thing that's going to come up is the page about karst and springs, and it has the link there so you can get the app, because the DNR doesn't have an app store, so we have to go about things a little differently, and try it out. Send in your spring locations. Like I said, we're hope to post a notice about this in the an upcoming newsletter here when we're about like 99% done with it. So contacts for the Minnesota spring inventory generally, I am mostly responsible for spring mapping in the Minnesota River Valley and everything north of that, and Jeff Green as for southeastern Minnesota and south central and southwestern Minnesota. So if you know of like someone who in your agency or anyone who has, you know, collected spring locations in your area, you'd like to share something about your favorite spring, you can certainly contact one of us. We'd be glad to hear from you. We're really trying to get citizen input into this whole program. So with that, I'll just open it to questions.
Do you run into many cases where the supposed spring is in fact an old flowing well, artesian well?
Those I run across in my spring inventory in the Minnesota River Valley. I have run across flowing wells, but usually they have such a high discharge, like 50 gallons per minute. It's like this looks like a flowing well. There is a category in the spring classification known as pipe, which covers all those kind of things. If I was out in the woods though, and I did not have the savvy to know that this does not have the appurtenances of a well, and I'm not really sure which, if it is a flowing well or a spring, I had to put it in the pipe category, which means this is, and flag it there, that this is, because many, I should say for others, many springs were improved in the early days. They're genuine springs, but they were improved by people ramming pipes down into them and hopefully to increase the flow. The Glenwood Inglewood Spring in Minneapolis is a good example. That was just kind of a little dribble. And in the 1800s, they ran a pipe down there, and they were getting an enormous flow out of there.
Hey, Greg. Greg, over here. Mm-hmm. We're right in the front. Got a question for you on... You have the littoral springs, but you also have a classification of springs that are in lakes. Are you collecting that type of information at all?
Littoral springs is basically going to have to cover it for that. In the Wisconsin survey, one of the things I showed you the map of the Wisconsin Conservation Department survey, and that there are 10,000 springs. And one of the things that I was warned right away is that when you really drill down on a lot of those points, especially in northern Wisconsin, they're not actually spring. You get to a spring-fed lake. And they are basing it just because the locals will say, yeah, this is a spring-fed lake, or because it has an outlet but no inlet, and then they'll classify that as a spring. And that's not the philosophy here. The spring actually has to be like roiling up the surface of the water or something like that for us to map it as a spring. You know, to go around in Minnesota, I mean, they're already, according to the coordinate surface area of Minnesota, you know, if Wisconsin has 10,000 springs with its surface area, Minnesota should have 15,000. I don't want 10,000 more lakes added onto that. Like, I have to, you know what I'm saying? It's like, so unless we can see an actual roiling of the water's surface or something like that, that lake, even though it's probably receiving diffuse inputs, it's not going to be mapped as a spring per se.
So, follow up. A spring may be roiling when you map it after a long series of rains, but you may revisit it some weeks or months later or a different year and it's dry.
Well, the only thing that's telling you is that it's an intermittent spring then. Then, since you're out in the field a second time, obviously, to make that observation, you could record that's intermittent spring. But we're not going to, like, remove that from the map or anything. I'm familiar with a number of intermittent springs right here in the Twin Cities, and those are still marked as spring locations. Sometimes you get people who, like, go deep into epistemology when there are classifications of springs. And I've seen some spring definitions most spring definitions will say a spring is like a groundwater discharge point. Others, more canny, and perhaps addressing your issue, will say it's not groundwater discharge. It's a place where groundwater can come out. And so maybe it addresses that issue. But I would just call that an intermittent. That's easy. There's really nothing problematic about that.
Do you, when you fill out your database, do you keep track of the date that it's observed and?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And the amount of water coming out at all?
Yeah, we have estimated discharges for the larger springs where they can, where it's, you know, there's of some importance. Then it's actually measured.
Yeah, Greg, this is a good talk. You mentioned a lot of uses for these data. Is there a threshold of how low you go? You mentioned 1 gallon a minute, statewide mapping. How low do you want to go?
Well, we've just been through the political season, so we can go pretty low. You know, I get it from both sides on that question that you just had. Calvin thinks I should map a continuum down to there should be no lower limit whatsoever. And then I talked to people in Wisconsin. They said 1 gallon per minute. You are crazy. I mean, we wouldn't look at anything like less than 0.25 cubic feet per second. Wouldn't even think about it. And I picked in my mapping in the Minnesota River Valley. And I've marched the whole way from the Twin Cities down to Mankato. 1 gallon per minute, it worked perfectly. If I have a higher threshold, there's nothing to do during these field days. It's like, there's a wet spot. I'm not going to map that. It's just too. It's 1 gallon per minute was really, I think, captured. Really captured the sort of lower limit that I want to. And some of these lower limit springs, you know, they're down to a gallon per minute, they may not be important to as for us, or historically or anything, but as working with Carrie Jennings here, and they are, if you get a broad band, for example, of mapped springs of 1 gallon per minute and nothing larger, that may indicate an area that's prone to landslide. So there is some value in going that low in mapping. But I think it's perfectly manageable because I've done it. So I've been out there and